Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you very much for coming to today's seminar. Today we have with us Maurizio Bussolo, who is lead economist at the World Bank's chief economist office for Europe and Central Asia. And today he's going to give us an introduction to this recently launched report by the World Bank that you can find information over there. So thank you very much.
Okay, great. Okay, very good. Thank you. Thank you all for coming and for the invitation to coming here. The report, there are some still there of the overview, which is the shorter, the smaller thing, and then there are some actual full report. But the report is also available online, so that you can download fully the whole report. And online, there's also data that you can download and play around. There are some more things, blogs and stuff. So there's more material to find. just Google ECA, Europe and Central Asia, World Bank Social Contract, and you'll find it. Okay, so the idea for the report came actually from a shorter piece that we did 3-4 years ago, where we were observing a polarization of the voting, meaning that the electorate was shifting its votes towards the extreme parties on the right and on the left. And in that smaller study, we tried to figure out whether there were some hypothesis, economic hypothesis, explanations for that choices of voting, and we tried a few very very quickly, and then we decided, okay, so this deserves more in-depth work, and so we worked on this for 24 months. So it's not a huge program of research of 5 years, but it's probably also will continue. And what we did here is to look at one specific type of economic hypothesis that may be behind this, which has to do with inequality or distribution of attention. So the starting point is rather simple. We have heard these mega trends of globalization, forces, technological, rapid technological change, aging for Europe specifically. It's quite important, especially for Western Europe. By the way, I cover, and this is not a global study, but I cover a region which is the transition economies, including Russia, Turkey, Central Asia, and also the Western Europe. But some of the things apply to other areas. So if you start from there, you see that these forces have created lots of opportunities, but also cleavages within the society. When you analyze that, you have a lot of contribution, enormous literature. If I have to summarize what we do in this report, there are four main contributions. So if you remember these four things that we do from the first slide, I'll be happy, and that's the main messages of the report. So the first thing that we do is that comes a little bit from me having to do some persuasion to senior management, because in Europe and Central Asia is a region where inequality is not very high, especially compared to other parts of the world, and in terms of trends it doesn't seem to go so high. So in terms of level and trends, doesn't seem to be a big problem. There has been an increase in inequality, I'll show you, in the aftermath of the transition. So between 89, 95, there has been a big spike. And so if you compare the situation from the fall of the Berlin Wall to today, yes, inequality is higher, but if you compare 95 to today, not so much. Then it depends a little bit on the context. So why doing something on inequality? Well, the first contribution is that, in fact, the nature of the distribution of attention has changed. And we take an analytical choice, which is similar to what others have done. In particular, here it's worthwhile mentioning the wider lecture of Frances Stewart, which is, I think, was the fifth edition of 2001, where she talks about these horizontal inequalities. So rather than looking at inequality between individuals or between all households, it's looking at discrepancies or disparities between averages of of groups. Okay, and when you start looking at that, you see that there are distributional tensions. There are tensions in the distributions of income, consumption, assets, etc. And these tensions, as Frances Stewart mentioned, are really important when you care about identity, you care about social cohesion, and so on. And I'll tell you more about that. Also, even if there has been a constant gene inequality or vertical inequality, the process through which this inequality is generated can become more unfair and be felt more unfair. So we also look at the inequality of opportunity, so which is another form, if you wish, of looking at horizontal inequality. So that's the first contribution. The nature of inequality is changing. You have to go beyond vertical inequality, and we document that. The second point that I needed to do some convincing. Okay, you're talking about Europe and Central Asia, ex planned economy, where there has been and there are extensive institutions that regulate the market, that protect the more vulnerable, and where there is a lot of redistribution. So we have all sets of institutions that are. Were constructed to deal with distribution tension. Why worrying about that? Well, these institutions still do a lot of redistribution post market, if you wish, with tax and transfer. They do quite well pre market in terms of education, coverage, health, etc. But they weren't designed really to deal with these horizontal tension. And in the report, we show that indeed, in some cases, they exacerbate some of the disparities that we worry about. So the third and fourth, the third is that, okay, so think in terms of one and two being the supply of equity, if you wish, which is what is generated by the market and what is enhanced or protected or changed by the government intervention, and look at the demand for equity. And what we show is that there is a sense that it's not satisfied, the demand for equity. So there is a deficit. There is still a lot of demand for equity. The most subjective perception of the situation is that it's worsening, why there is this gap, and so we talk about that. And so when you have these three things together, you figure out that there may be not things are not stable, there is not balance, and so there begin to be cracks in the social context. And so what to do about that is the fourth and last contribution, which we are beginning to a debate about how to bring these things in balance again. So that's the story of the report in one slide. What I do now in the rest of the time is just giving you details of all of these pieces. Before doing that, let me give you again one kind of preliminary view of what we mean by social contract, because there is a huge tradition, is a heavyweight terminology, social contract. And it's a little bit of marketing too. You want to have an attractive title. There is an inflation of reports all over. So, but we have thought about that, and we have a view of how do we use this and how we define that. And that's that comes from other literature that is not really the philosophical tradition or political science tradition that goes back to Hobbes, Locke, Rousseau, but it's more the game theory approach of Binmore and others. Ravi Kambhur has a similar approach when he talks about the context of occupational taxation, etc. So our view is that it's a stable social contract is an equilibrium in a a dynamic equilibrium between these three elements. One is, again, the distribution of resources that are generated by the market, the correction of that by government intervention, public intervention, and the social preference for equity that are at the bottom. The redistribution, don't think just as post-market, but think in terms of, as I said earlier, of pre-market redistribution, which is preparing the individuals to enter the labor market, or protecting them, or in terms of education, health, etc. So it's pre-market this redistribution, if you wish. Then in-market is regulation, and post-market it will be tax and transfer. Okay, so it's not just tax and transfer. Just to make sure. So the disequilibrium can originate if any of these move not in sync with the others. Okay, so if there is a sense that the situation is not fair anymore, and neither of these move, but these move, there is a disequilibrium. If this one moves and the other don't adapt, there is a disequilibrium. And so what the report shows is that there are sources of unbalancing all across these three elements. So in graphical terms, non-analytical terms, so forgive me for being a bit World Bank here, very, very simple graph, but that's what a representation of the framework that we, conceptual framework that we use. So we have the market generation, the public policy, and the social preference for inequality. And I'll talk a little bit about these three. I give you an example about all of this, and I start from the market. I mentioned that when you look at the Gini coefficient of vertical inequality, which is inequality measured on the incomes of individuals or households, this is what we see in the region. And as I said, these are subregions, aggregations of subregions, and you have five subregions, and clearly there has been from 88 to 95, then increasing inequality linked to the transition, and then this is as kind of remained fairly stable. So a big caveat here is that we are using household surveys and not administrative data, so we don't have the top incomes. If you were to use that, you would see that there has been a concentration of incomes at the top. The whole Paris School of Economics data shows that, but still, that's mainly true for a subset of countries in Europe, not across the board. And we report data in the report. Again, Southern Europe, which is the group of countries that has the highest level of inequality, is at 0.35, which in terms of inequality is low compared to other parts of the world. So if you want to go beyond that, you have to. That's what we do, where we look at these disparities across groups, and we look at three, especially in particular three groups, which are generations, birth cohorts, occupations, labor market related, and spatial. We miss some, two in particular. One would be gender, if you wish. The other one would be natives versus non-natives, but we would need much more space, so we limit these to these three, and then we look at the process of generation of these inequality, which is the inequality of opportunity. Let me give you some example, a couple of slides on generation or birth cohort inequality. But think of these not just as comparing in a cross section older people and younger people, but it's really think of both the cohort and the age effect. So I want to compare not only in a cross section what happens to in a specific year what happens to a group of people that are young in that year and a group of people that are old in that year. But I want to try to compare what happened along the life cycle. So what happens if a cohort was born in the 30s and I measure their inequality or their level of wages when they are 30 with a cohort that was born in the 80s and in 2010 are 30, and I compare these two at 30 year old. So I want to disentangle a little bit the cohort and age effect. So I'll give you just a few snapshots here. This is two regions, two sub-regions, Western and Southern Europe, and I compare here the incidence of the non-standard employment by different age groups in different years. So when I compare these dots, these are not people that age, but are different cohorts, okay? They are always, I measure them always for 40, 44, and I measure at different years, so these are born in different times. So these are showing me this difference. So what this graph shows initially is that, okay, there is a trend that is stronger in Southern Europe for the incidence of non-standard employment, which is fairly high, and also for Western Europe, slightly less steep, but it's similar across all cohorts. It's not that the incidence is super strong for one particular cohort, but when I add the younger cohorts, what I notice is that in the past, so for cohorts that were born in the past, everyone, all the age group were fairly close. Now, for cohorts that are all born more recently, this has opened up. So the incidence is much stronger of these uncertainty in the labor market for some younger cohort than older cohort. So there's a difference of the risks perception uncertainty in the labor market that goes beyond measuring income. Okay, but even if we look at income, and this is another way of looking at the story. Here I have again cohorts. Here I have again years, but now these are actually cohorts that age. So along the curve is the same group of people, and I follow them between the age 30, 34 for 5 years, and in a moment where they have entered the labor market, but they're not at the very beginning. And there are two groups again for Southern Europe. This is a bit different for other parts of the region, and these are high school graduate and these are college graduate. And the high school graduate, no matter if they were from an old cohort or a more recent cohort, they were already flat. So the growth of their wages wasn't really strong. But for college graduate, there has been a flattening of the profile of the growth of the wage. Okay, so younger cohorts, which are here, vis-a-vis older cohorts, have seen a strong flattening of their wage. There's a similar study done for the U.S., which finds very similar pattern, and we do some more analysis in the report. Is this demand or supply? Is there more education that flattens it, or is the demand less demand? They end up on the American study of saying that they think it's more due to a drop in demand, automation that requires less of them, and so that flattened. But again, the incidence is different across different cohorts, so that's what I want you to remember, to take. One other way of looking at it, rather than comparing levels, which were occupation or incidence of type of employment, compare now the within country, within cohort level of inequality. This is similar kind of data, but I look at, now I have the date of birth here on the horizontal axis and the inequality within the group of different cohorts. So three countries, France, Germany, and Italy. I focus on Italy since I'm Italian. So this is my parents' cohort, 1930. When I measure the inequality they had when they are 30, 35, and they were living in a country, if they just looked at their peers, their age group, that was had an inequality of similar to Japan, 0.319. The cohort that was born in the 1980, and I measure again the inequality across their, within their group, is now they live in a different country, they live in G. So the level of competition, the level of disparity within the cohort at the same age, as this is just a cohort effect, has increased quite strongly. You don't see this effect yet on consumption. So if I measure instead of that, I measure consumption. So there is some intergenerational distribution that allows that, but this is, it cannot be sustained probably. And so there will be translated also in that. So this is some snapshot of showing things that happen when you begin comparing cohorts, birth cohorts, that don't translate yet to the Gini level, but we show that if the aging continues, etc., you can expect later on in the future that the whole society may be aging and become more unequal. And there's a whole study that the OECD put out for a bunch of countries, which it's all about this. So I have others, which are this one was on occupation. There's a whole story about the polarization of occupation, but I don't want to, for the sake of time, I don't want to go there. I give you another example of the usefulness of going beyond the standard measure. And that is the story of the middle class. So I talked about the Gini, the vertical inequality, but there's a lot of talk also about shrinking, hollowing out of the middle class. If you measure the middle class either in absolute or relative terms, and we do that fairly carefully, you don't see that very clearly. There is not a shrinking of the middle class. But if you measure the level of uncertainty, vulnerability of the middle class. So if you look at the middle class from a different point of view, you find a quite different story. And that's what we do in a part of the report. And let me give you some the main result. So we calculate, we think of the middle class as one of the main characteristics being secure from risk of falling into poverty. So we define poverty as being below $21 a day, and then we have a panel, the EU Silk panel, and we look at this period, 2005-2008, and we measure how many people fall into poverty, and then we calculate, we estimate the probability, and we come up with this, we calculate the probability of falling into poverty, and we measure, this is what is measured there. On the same group of people, we calculate what is the income that they need to be below these probability. And so if we fix a probability that is low enough, which is about 8%, so that's the income that they have, it's $34 a day. If you have $34 a day, in 2005-08, you have a probability of falling into poverty that is below that. So that's a lower threshold to belong to the middle class. Later on, we do the same calculation for 2011 and 14, and what we found is that the whole curve shifts up, and so now it's become 40. To have the same level of low probability, you have to have a 20% increase in your income to be from 34 to 30 to be able to be protected and have a low probability to fall into poverty. So in other words, this is, you can think of this as an insurance premium that you have to pay. That risk is not insurable yet. It doesn't exist a market for insuring that. But that's what you need. So the vulnerability has increased, and so you have to have a higher income to feel protected. And we also look at what are the people around here in terms of their characteristics, and I don't have time, but they change the identity of the people around the threshold change in line with the our distributional tension among groups. So we have a correlation of these two things. Okay, so I'm just on the first part. I can't go through the inequality of opportunity of fairness story in detail, but let me maybe tell you one thing without the detail. So that so the main idea is that people tolerate a certain level of inequality if that inequality is generated by things that people control. So there is a very interesting study for Poland that people appreciated the increasing inequality. They were happy to have more inequality at the beginning because they thought, okay, now if I put effort, I can access the higher level. The wage spread reflect a spread in the effort. So higher inequality is tolerated if it reflects efforts. But if it reflects circumstances that you are not controlled, then it's felt unfair. So what we do is calculating what is called inequality of opportunity, and seeing in particular, we found that in Europe, inequality of opportunity for education went down. So it doesn't matter what your parents' level of education is for your own, because there has been a democratization of education, very strong. The second thing that happened that we measure is that the premium that education pays off has gone down. So the skill premium has gone down. For these two reasons, it doesn't matter, even if your parents transmit you an asset, which is their education transmitted to education for you, this asset has become less valued by the market. For these two reasons, you should see inequality of opportunity going down in the space of income, but in fact it doesn't. So it has remained constant, and that is because what we measure, there is still an influence from your parental background to you. So they transmit some immaterial assets, which we call parental networking, that are important for your position in the income distribution. So there is still a channel, and that we measure residually, and that is that. So it may be that your parents have been to a good school, and so they have connection in the labor market. It may be that they have a good position in the labor market, and that is transmitted to you, helping you finding better position. So that's what we have on the first part. The second, as I said, is on public policy. So these are, as I said, we have good institutions to redistribute, to take control of this, and so we shouldn't worry. Indeed, the Europe and Central Asia for the EU 28, so I include the UK, it should begin talking about EU 27 maybe. I'm all recorded here, so I have to be careful. But the EU 28 statistics shows you that on average, or the average for all these 28 is 21 Gini points. So market income before tax and transfers, the Gini is 0.550. The Gini post tax and transfer is 29. So the reduction of vertical inequality is amazing. So they are still, and this measure is for 2014, I think. And we saw, as this measure changed through time, not that much. In some countries, actually in France, has increased the redistribution, the vertical redistribution. In some other, in Greece, has increased. So in the East is 50-50, but it hasn't decreased. So the system still delivers enormously in terms of vertical, but not so much in terms of horizontal. I give you one example of tax and transfer. We have example of the regulation of the labor market, which is also important, and other examples. But in terms of tax and transfer, this is Hungary, and is two periods, age groups, in 2007, 2014. Hungary went through a flattening of the tax system. This is the percentage of gross income, taxation as a percentage of gross income, and these are age groups. So in what happened in the with the flattening between these two periods is that the younger group are now under more pressure than the older group. So there has been an exacerbation. I showed you earlier that there are intergenerational disparities, and these disparities are a little bit increased by the taxation. And we show that using microsimulation, Euromod system, we show that, in fact, if you were to apply to the blue line, which is the earlier line, the tax to apply to the population of 2014, the tax system of 2007, you would get the yellow line. So from the blue to the green is not just a change in age group or something that makes the tax system change in the incidence, but it's actually policy change itself that changed that. And as I said, there is an increased taxation here of the young and a decrease in the for the old. This is just one example. Let me move quickly to the third and last part of the positive analysis, then I have a little bit of a discussion about policies. So, of what to do about this. So I am, so the way we start looking at that is by showing that there is this gap between perception of inequality and actual inequality. This is from the LITS, the Life in Transition survey, which is a survey that we run with the EBRD, the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development in London, a regional bank. And we have done it in 2000, 2005, 2015. This is the latest one. In 2015, there was a question that asked people, what do you think has happened to inequality in the last 5 years? And has it increased, has remained stable, or has it decreased? And what I show on the vertical axis is the net, the difference between those share of people that say it has increased minus those that say it has decreased. So it's how many more people than those who say it has decreased believe it has increased. And on the horizontal axis, you have the actual change in the gene. So for half of the country, the gene changes. They're not big changes, but it reduces, and for half of the country, it increases a bit. But everybody and a large number believe has gone up, much more than has gone down. So there is a sense that a gap between what people think is happening and what actually we economists measure. Now. Even if there are small changes, one thing that you want to take into consideration, even if there are small changes, Europe is a region where there is a strong commitment and a strong sense of equity. Equity preferences are high. I'll show you just one other evidence from the World Value Survey. This is the percentage of people that believe that you can escape poverty without any help. It's 70% in the US, 40 in Europe, and even less, 24 in Eastern Europe. So there is a sensitivity to, even if changes in inequality are small, they count a lot for Europeans for many, many, many reasons. But what is then behind the sensitivity? What is behind this sense that no more than the sensitivity? What is behind the fact that they are saying that things are becoming more complicated than we actually measure? Well, there's a group of people that just say that they are misperceiving inequality. They don't know what inequality is, so we should just dismiss them. But what we do is actually, no, maybe it's not that they are wrong, and neither that the inequality measured by the gene is useless, but maybe there are other things that they care of. And one theme that we go on and on is this insecurity. What I show you here is, again, using LITS, the answer to a question that asks them to people the following. if you today are to put your family into a 10-step ladder, where the bottom ladder is for the 10% poorest and the top 10th ladder is for the 10% richest, where do you put your family? And what I show here is the probability of putting yourself on the first two steps, the poorest two, the 20% bottom. And I calculate an ordered probit to control for various things. And one of the things that I control is actual position, because I know where they are in actual. And so that's what I show you here, which is clearly downward sloping. The richer believe less, but still someone who's actually at the tendency I still report that. But what is more interesting is to look at the difference between these two curves. The difference between these two curves is that the green is for people who have been employed 12 months in the last year, and these others are not. So if I compare these curves, controlling for everything else, for example, for the sixth decile, that is people that have the same income but generated by a different process. And those who have a process that is less secure, more vulnerable, always feel more poor, declare that being more poor. And that is equivalent in monetary terms to that gap, which is the equivalent of three actual deciles. So if you want to compensate for this insecurity in monetary terms, you would have to give them a huge transfer. Or read in other ways that they value security, predictability, etc., very much. And probably it's not the best thing to do is not just to transfer money, okay? So, and then we have more analysis of why the other factors that may influence perception, etc. And we care about perception because perception are linked to demand for a distribution, which is linked to voting, okay? All right, so is there an imbalance? Yes, probably. I showed that there are forces that actively have moved the policy in an unbalancing direction, and these also are showing imbalances. What we do next is that we show that correlation, not causation, we show that if we have good data on the voting, and we can see that those who have increased the most they're voting to the extreme are actually the losers of some of the distributional tension. So there is correlation that you can link the voting to the tension that we show. For example, also for the age groups, the young have always voted less than the old, but the gap is increasing. So not only in terms of voice, but also in terms of exit, there are correlations between the distributional tension, the losing side, and the voting behavior. So these are cracks in the social contract. What happened? Okay. So what to do next? Note the cracks when we were writing this weren't riots in the streets. I was in Paris before here, where you have probably heard that the gilets jaunes, the yellow jacket, I don't know how is the translation in English, but there are riots in the streets. It's not like in the 70s in Europe with the industrial relations, the strikes, etc., because there are no more unions. So looking at the cracks in the social contract, you have to think a bit differently. But clearly, with the voting is one thing, and now you see separatist movement and all of that. So what to do about that? We don't have much... in terms of specific policy reforms. And also, we don't want to think about policy reforms. If we want to think about the whole idea of social contract, you have to be fairly radical. You don't want to talk about reforming something, but you want to talk, how do you want to organize your society? So it should be just a discussion among not just policymakers, executive branch, but everybody, the whole society. But to come up with some guidelines, we think about three principles that you should think of when redesigning the social contract. These three principles are simple and not radical, perhaps, but you have to think in terms of the trend is going the opposite direction of the trends that we have observed. The first one is that delinking the social protection the regulation, the treatment of workers from the employment arrangement that they have. So it doesn't matter what kind of employment relationship you have, you should have the same rights. And that, by the way, doesn't mean necessarily reducing the protection of the insiders. It could be one way, but it could be also increasing the protection of the outsider. But it's a leveling the playing field, portability of the pensions. There are lots of ways, and let me show the radical part of this, which doesn't seem shattering. But in my institution, a lot of the social protection business, lending, dialogue with the countries is about targeting. So it's helping setting up CCT, conditional cash transfer system, or targeting, which is different from going towards a more universal approach, which is also linked to this second one, which is really about universality. If you look at the pre-distribution, as I said at the beginning, Europe has reached a good level of universal coverage in terms of health insurance and education, etc. But in terms of economic insecurity, economic risk, which are increasing, their incidence is not uniform. Risks are like that, and there is lack of insurance. And now to go more universal in terms of insurance, we think it's a good way to go. And we have a discussion. We don't endorse, we don't support, but we should have a serious debate about the UBI among other things. And so if these two are on the giving side, if you wish, and go towards universal, the taxing side, also the revenue side, oh, this is the referendum for the UBI in Switzerland that didn't pass, but there are many examples. The last budget, I don't remember the name, the budget document for India was all about setting up a UBI in India. So it's well beyond Europe now. So the last one is that we should also to have an more equity-friendly social contract or rebalancing social contract, you should also look for a tax system that is broad and, again, progressive. The trend has been that progressivity has gone down in the income taxation. Think of the example that I showed you of Hungary, the flattening of the tax, income tax, but also to be broad, it has to include capital. Yes, so that's what we think it should contain. And again, we don't think that you can advance on a redesign of social contract if you choose only one. You have to keep the three. For example, discussion on the UBI in isolation, it doesn't make sense if you don't talk about how you finance the UBI. So you have to keep these three together. So as I said, everything is online, and I talked enough, and I stop here. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So now we have a few minutes for questions.
So I've also been working on horizontal inequality, but more on ethnic, horizontal inequality in ethnic terms. So I really appreciated the way you've demonstrated the sort of rise in horizontal inequality using all these different measures along different dimensions. I guess I'm sort of left with maybe two questions. So one question is about, in terms of the connection between rising inequality and voting, the counter hypothesis, sort of in light of a lot of discussion in political science, certainly, is that it's not necessarily these economic issues, economic tensions that are driving the far right vote, that it's just racism, racial attitudes, really. whatever attitudes toward migration and globalization that we're having. So I wonder how you respond to that. There's, for instance, in U.S. politics, there's a lot of discussion about this, new surveys and so on, trying to tease out what's driving the far right vote. And then the other question I have is about how you get sort of from your analysis to the new social contract. So if I'm understanding right, you're saying, you're showing that, that rising inequality is leading to a rise of the far right vote. You're suggesting that. And then you're saying what we need is this the new social contract. But I don't see, if we've got a rise in the far right vote coming from this rise in inequality, how do we get from whoever the politicians are voted in to the new social contract? How do you get from that political situation
Sure. Okay. Yes. Shall I answer or shall I?
I may forget them then.
Okay. So as I said, we don't look at the horizontal inequality between natives and immigrants, which is something that you are doing, and it's probably quite important. And so I have potentially a missing link to explain the voting. However, when we, and there are also studies for the U.S. when you look at the voting pattern of the natives, you begin to find correlations. David Autor found even some ways of doing causation between people that are losing job opportunities and because they have certain occupations that I didn't talk about that, but if we found that people that are in routine occupations, which is one of the grouping that which are more under pressure from trade, etc., and technological, they are either finding jobs in non-routine manual, which are below in terms of wage level, etc., or they lose jobs, and then they tend to vote to the extreme parties. So there is this discussion between, is it economic anxiety or is racism, which I don't deny and I don't disprove in this, but I just bring some evidence that there is also some economic link. So there is some economic insecurity that is important, they're not mutually exclusive, the two explanations. The other thing that I can add is that indeed if before, and there are studies on that as well, if before your identity, so going back to Francis Stewart, the whole idea of importance of horizontal inequality is that you care about what happens to your group, you still care about what happens within your group. If your group becomes more unequal, you still care. But when there is identity around your group, you care about the fate of your group. And if the fate of your group, say middle class, was that they had a fairly secure job, kind of job, and they were diverse in the middle class, but what made them feel cohesive was that these opportunities were for everybody. Once that is broken, then the group identity doesn't form anymore around economic opportunity, having a certain kind of job, etc., but it starts to form towards nationalistic identity and ethnic identity. So the identity changes nature, and so it goes. Then it becomes more important. But the two things are linked. So you know. So that's my first answer. The second one is we don't go into how to change the election rules or the rules of how to elect representative and remove representative, etc. So if you look at the IPSP, the International Panel on Social Progress, which is led by Ravi Kambur at Cornell, Mark Florbey at Princeton, and a group of 300 and more. They have a lot about, they expand, they were advisor to our reporter, but they expand much more, so you find the answer there. So they talk about we may want to change the rules of representations and how the political game is played in the lobbying and the communication and the media. So there's a lot of other things that that are important for changing the social contract that are not mentioned here. I don't know if that's sort of the okay. So I don't have all the answers. This is just the first attempt. Yes.
There was a question.
Tony, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I was just wondering. It's fascinating stuff. Wondering how economic geography plays into this and spatial inequality, which is another dimension.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, we have the north of England, we have West Virginia, we have southern Italy. And obviously a lot of distributional tensions around that neglected areas to the degree that drives the Gilets Jaunes phenomenon in France. And actually, for the World Bank, you know, there's a kind of policy implication there, because the old World Bank used to do lots of infrastructure.
Right.
So if you look at Europe in the 1950s, you know, the World Bank was putting money into concrete, you know, autostrada and railway systems, and you know, trying to reduce the polarization on a geographical framework.
Right.
The bank really doesn't kind of do that much anymore. So I wonder what your thoughts were around that.
Yes. No, good question. Thanks. So there are two things. One is that you can think in terms of technological progress that has driven a lot of the agglomeration in the past, and so it was really important to you were the most productive. Industry tended to agglomerate, so it was important to have people move away and into centers. You can think now that there is this atomization of production, and you can work from home, or you have several bosses, so maybe it's less important to be so much in the center, in the urban center. So that's, if you wish, maybe the importance of communication and infrastructure has become again useful, but a different type of infrastructure: the internet connection, the wire, the telephone system, and we have some studies there. But one thing that we look at is this is also important for some Eastern country in Central Asia. There are issues as access to housing in urban areas are not so universal, and so people don't migrate to more productive center because they cannot afford the housing. So there are issues of policy that are not. That create a distributional tension. So that's one. One other, I was at another conference during the preparation of this, which there was a very interesting presentation, two papers, one on the US and one on Sweden, I think, some Nordic countries. So they were looking at, in the US, they were looking at the portability or the system, the health insurance system. And they were looking at two group of people. One that had young people that had insurance from their parents, and another one the insurance from their employer. The first group did much more; it was much more mobile, job to job, and presumably geographically, because they had the insurance of if something happened in health, they were covered. The others did much less. job search, job shopping, and so they were stuck in unemployment. And so the second group is much more, operates in a segmented market, so less efficient. In a way, the first group then end up in better jobs, and so earn more money, and it's in terms of efficiency improved. So that are, again, insurance system may create less mobility. It's not necessarily an investment in infrastructure, but it's another type of invest. In the Swedish case, they were trying to understand why people don't move away from poor neighborhood or a poor rural area, remote areas, and go to the big cities, and that is because these people tend to rely a lot on informal insurance from the family network, so they had data for that in a country like Sweden, which is so it was pretty amazing. But that's another way of so you don't necessarily have to think about big concrete infrastructure, but there are other interventions that can help the mobility. But, so that's my answer.
I'm picking up a bit on the last point, is that I have a vested interest in promoting inequality of wealth as opposed to just income.
Promoting inequality or equality of wealth?
Well, both, or promoting the study of the
sure,
inequality
sure,
of wealth.
Sure.
So, and you think, basically, the evidence suggests that income inequality hasn't really changed very much over the last 20 years or so. It's been fairly flat. Mm. Wealth inequality has increased since the financial crisis.
Mm.
And a large amount of this is driven by asset prices because of low interest rates. So
yes.
You've got a situation in which wealth inequalities increase because people at the top have done particularly well out of equity markets, which have just exploded, but also a pretty well strong housing price growth in the last 20 years and so on as well. So when you're looking at inequalities, the sort of tension you're getting is, at least, I mean, I'm just throwing in this as another aspect, that people are noticing that there are some groups that seem to be doing particularly well and perhaps resenting that, and that particularly the very high wealth people are doing exceptionally well. And you see, at least, it's in the UK, but I think it's quite widely true in other countries, they have an impact on, you see, the whole of the British Football League, I mean, is now owned by billionaires, as far as one could identify.
Yeah.
Or if they're not billionaires, they're aspiring billionaires.
Yes.
And they also own so much of the media, pretty well, so much of the newspapers and the television stations in these countries. So you've got a real, if you like, the inequality there is feeding through media control, and that I think is stoking, you see this in the US as through Fox News and so on.
Mm-hmm.
You see a lot of right-wing propaganda
yes.
being promoted in this way. So I mean, you haven't said anything about that, but I think that there's a dimension there. The other dimension is that, for a lot of younger people now, house prices in a lot of countries are becoming too expensive. You mentioned people are not moving because of housing is becoming too
yeah.
expensive. And so there's another dimension here in terms of the other, apart from financial assets and control of various sorts of important things which do influence people's attitudes, also people being unable and so there's a change in this sort of structure there. The third thing, which I think is important here in the longer run, which you didn't mention at all, I think is to do with an aging population. And then you get people, people who are getting older, and if they're not making provision, then you get a problem of really the fact that there's that they're not saving enough. That
sure.
preventing it has repercussions for them. And I think, one other dimension here is that there's what we discovered in the wealth aspect is that you get a lot of, in the north, it seems to be the Scandinavia or the Nordic countries, plus probably Germany and the Netherlands, they all have quite a decent welfare system, and therefore the people, in terms of their, people don't have to save very much.
Mm-hmm.
During, at least they feel that the state's going to look after them, provide them with a decent pension, and cover their medical needs. And so you get other countries where that is not the case,
mm-hmm.
and there's a, you know, there's another problem there about when people are not saving enough and are not developing assets. So I must say, I think this is quite an important aspect, and that perhaps identifying the difference between the attitudes in, as I say, the Nordic countries plus Germany and the Netherlands,
mm.
and somehow whether or not their balance of the sort of pressures and demands and redistribution and the way that they solve that problem is different from the other countries, which particularly in Eastern Europe is much more sort of laissez-faire and
right.
almost completely market, left of market.
Right, right. No, okay, so you raise a series of important issues, so I don't know if I can answer all of that, but let me try some. Okay. starting from the bottom, the last one perhaps. So I mentioned the fact that we try to look at is to look at the evolution of inequality across time following cohorts, so we care about the age and the cohort effect. It's a very technical way of answering, but let me explain better. So if we there is and Deaton has written about that, there is an age effect that if you a group of individuals, as they age, their inequality within that group increases through time. But there is also a cohort effect, which is not every cohort begin with the same level of inequality. And what I showed is that the younger cohorts now begin their lives already with the more spread incomes. And when these, because of the age effect, if nothing changes, but if because of the age effect, when these people will be older, there will be age in society will potentially be much more unequal because of the age effect that normally opens up, and because of the cohorts that begin. So the mechanism through which this happens, one is what I said, the transmission, intergenerational transmission, but the fact that some parents can help their kids buying a house, you don't see then that much inequality still in terms of consumption, because there is a lot of help passed on, but potentially you will see in the future. So so there is we it's important to consider the dynamic story and the saving and the aging, and we do a bit of that. In terms of the assets and the wealth, which are clearly connected, because savings is just accumulation of assets, but in terms of that, I think what we are not having enough discussion is that monetary policy has been, policies of the central bank has been venerated as the best thing for growth and for inflation, but I don't think that they have very clearly examine the impact on relative prices. So the fact that they have kept in a moment where inflation wasn't a big issue, and they wanted to boost growth, they have kept interest rates very low. There was no problem of inflation, so inflation was under control, and growth has probably benefited, but it has created this relative price issue very strong that you pointed out. Asset prices in an era of low interest prices, has all the liquidity has gone into assets, and asset prices have become much. Have gone up, and so there has been a relative price effect of the a long time of low interest rates. And I don't think we have we have discussed enough of that, and I don't know whether the solution would be necessarily of imposing a new target for central bankers to just not look just at inflation but look at relative prices, because they have no instruments. So I don't know that, but I agree with you that there's something that is important that has driven the concentration of wealth that is through the asset prices. And then there is the process itself, which is how you accumulate these assets. How do you is it through actual competition in the markets that the best minds, the best entrepreneurs, the best firms get to the shareholder of these assets? Or shall we talk about a little bit of these redistribution of assets? The Mark Florbet that I cited before, he doesn't think that a good idea would be, but this is a discussion that we don't go into the details, not necessarily a good idea to talk about a capital income taxation or an asset taxation, but he thinks that potentially an inheritance tax, an estate tax, would be a good idea. Atkinson's wrote in his last book about this proposal that is, so we could with an inheritance tax, we could all the revenues could be used for creating an endowment for when you become 15, in people get this endowment, which is equal for everybody and financed by wealth tax. So these we tangentially begin talking about that, and indeed are important. We didn't go and added a lot of positive analysis because the Paris School of Economics, they have done a lot of work, so we report that, and I don't talk about that here, but there is some of that. And I agree with you that that's an important aspect.
Okay, thank you very much. We don't have time for more questions. Maybe after the seminar, we can.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.